Warning! The following podcast contains adult language, sexual imagery, and stuff to make you say, "Man, that's a dirty play." You have been warned. Well met, and welcome to episode 128, the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for May the 15th, 2016. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and in this podcast, we continue our three-month-long discussion of King Lear with a look at the old nudge-nudge, wink-wink. Or in this play's case, just a sigh and a shake of the head. In other words, the first half of this podcast is going to be bawdy, and in the second half, we'll talk about nothing. I mean, really, nothing. So, here's your warning. Warning! The following podcast contains adult language, sexual imagery, and stuff to make you say, "Man, that's a dirty play." You have been warned. Skip to the 10-minute, 10-second mark if easily offended. Now, I usually like to say that these bawdy podcasts contain sophomoric humor, but this one's pretty much humorless, so I'm sorry in advance. You know me, I love the bawdy. And as we go through King Lear, I'm feeling much like I felt during Hamlet, that this play pretty much sucks the fun out of bawdy, and not in a good way. And I'm not alone in that opinion. Eric Partridge, in his great dictionary of dirt in the bard, Shakespeare's bawdy, says about the same. Compare the remarks at Hamlet, than which it is, however, both less witty in its witty sexual passages, and less eloquent and impressive in its sexual invectives. So unlike the old Miller Lite beer commercials, I really can't say, "Less witty, reads great." Now our first bit of bawdy comes quick, no pun intended, within mere sonnets worth of lines. When Gloucester makes some ambiguous statement regarding Edmund's breeding, Kent says that he doesn't understand, "I cannot conceive you." And this is where Gloucester tries an attempted bit of wit. "Sir, this young fellow's mother could, whereupon she grew round-wombed and had, indeed, sir, a son for her cradle ere she had a husband for her bed." Get it? Conceive? Understand? Get pregnant? Partridge is right. Less witty indeed. And Gloucester only gets worse in his discussion of sex with Edmund's mother. "Though this knave came something saucily to the world before he was sent for, yet was his mother fair. There was good sport at his making, and the whoreson must be acknowledged." Okay, he says that the baby mama was attractive, fair, but it's downhill from there. He remarks at the fun he had screwing her, remember it's his making after all and not love making, and then calls Edmund a whoreson, which isn't far from calling Edmund's mother a whore. Not a fun start to the bawdy in this play, especially when you remember that all of this is being said in Edmund's presence. Now, when we first meet the fool later in Act 1, he compares his treatment at the hands of both Lear and his daughters, tossing in a barely profane pun. "I marvel what kin thou and thy daughters are. They'll have me whipped for speaking true, thou'lt all have me whipped for lying, and sometimes I'm whipped for holding my peace." The fool bemoans his situation. The daughters beat him for telling the truth, Lear beats him for lying, and the fool claims that he's been beaten for silence. Or, has he been beaten for masturbation, holding his peace? Not a great joke, but at least funnier than Gloucester's. When the fool later tries to distract Lear from his downturning state, after leaving Goneril, he tells the old king, "I can tell why a snail has a house, to put his horns in, not to give it away to his daughters and leave his horns without a case." Here the use of the term horns has a double meaning. Snails have tentacles that look like horns, but horns were also symbolic of cuckolds, or men whose wives had been unfaithful. It's possible that the fool here is implying that Lear's daughters are illegitimate. And it can work, A, given the Gloucester subplot, and B, Lear's own statement that if Regan had welcomed him poorly, he might say that her mother's tomb was sepulchring and adulterous. Of course, don't forget that case also meant slang for vagina, so when the fool says, what he says, he's talking about a snail needs a shell like a man's horn, or cock needs a case, or a pussy. Again, not exactly the epitome of Shakespearean wit. The fool's later body snippets are no more complex. The codpiece that will house, in other words, a place to put one's cock, no heretics burned but wenches suitors, a whore's customer will burn with venereal disease. Her boat hath a leak, again a disease reference that follows and plays off poor Tom's song line, come o'er to the burn, Bessie, to me, and turning that poor Tom's burn from a stream to the effects of venereal disease. That same poor Tom, Edgar in disguise, also speaks of sex, but it's less fun than we would hope. He describes his fictional early life, and he talks of lust and sex, the act of darkness, and lots of it, out paramoured the Turk. All of this history has given him a moral conclusion. Stay out of whorehouses, keep your hands out of vaginas, plackets, and keep your cock pen out of whores' pussies, the lender's book, something that can be opened. Now poor Tom's brother, that bastard Edmund, he too has a little bawdiness, but his is surprisingly subtle. When Goneril gives him a kiss, she says, this kiss, if it durst speak, would stretch thy spirits up into the air. Conceive, and fare thee well. There is a kiss and a request for him to conceive or understand, but that's not the dirtiest thing that she says. In Shakespeare's day, spirit was a euphemism for semen. She's giving him a kiss that she promises will have him coming like a geyser. And his response, yours in the ranks of death, is a knowing, winking one. While his use of rank here is as a noun, the adjectival form of the word meant sexually dirty, obscene. And though he uses the noun death, we can't forget that to die was to experience a sexual orgasm. Later, when Edmund is speaking with the newly widowed Regan, she speaks not only of her own sexual needs, the goodness she intends upon Edmund, but her fear of his susceptibility to her sister's sexual aggressiveness. But have you never found my brother's way to the forfended place? If his earlier response to Goneril had been winking, this one about the older sister's forfended place, or pussy, is no less so. Twice he uses the word honor, a word that Partridge reminds us is a body pun on her. But I'm not sure Regan catches the innuendo. Edmund is a bastard. Our first body references of the play point to the act that created him. And our penultimate body section returns us to that sin. Lear, unconsciously, subconsciously, not knowingly, speaks before Gloucester of the punishment for adultery. I pardon that man's life. What was thy cause? Adultery? Thou shalt not die. Die for adultery? No. The wren goes to it, and the small gilded fly does lecher in my sight. Let copulation thrive. For Gloucester's bastard son was kinder to his father than my daughters got tween the lawful sheets. To luxury, pell-mell, for I lack soldiers. Behold yon simpering dame, whose face between her forks presages snow, that minces virtue and does shake the head to hear of pleasure's name. The fichu nor the soiled horse goes to it with a more riotous appetite. Down from the waist they are centaurs, the women all above. But to the girdle do the gods inherit. Beneath is all the fiends. There's hell, there's darkness, there's the sulphurous pit, burning, scalding, stench, consumption. There will be, under Lear's justice, no punishment for adultery, as all of nature does it. Birds, wrens, insects, flies, polecats, fichus, and horses. In fact, he calls for luxury or lechery as quickly as possible, pell-mell. He needs soldiers, and those soldiers need to be conceived. And the men will not be punished for this sin because it's all the women's fault. He conjures a simpering dame as his every woman. In Shakespeare's day, simper could mean either to be hot, to simmer, or to smirk. Either way, there's a lust heating her from within or from below. Because despite her graying pubic hair, the face between her forks, presages, snow, it's white, and her coy faux virtue. No, even this crone has a riotous appetite for sex. These are women from the waist up, but below the waist, they belong to the devil, the fiend, and the vagina is a sulphurous, burning pit. Women are agents of evil. Men, on the other hand, are smug bridegrooms ready to die bravely, or to die, or to die. Nudge, nudge. And on that sad bit of misogyny, we bid King Lear's Hamlet of Bodyville adieu and good riddance. Need some teaching resources? Need to adorn your teaching materials with some Shakespearean goodies? Well, check out the Bill Shakespeare Project page on the teacherspayteachers.com site. We've got materials on Romeo and Juliet, Julius Caesar, King Lear, Othello, Troilus and Cressida, and Titus Andronicus, with more on the way all the time. Plus, you can find the handout version of the periodic table of Shakespeare. Now, some are free, some are for purchase, but all quality items. And for those of you who are asking for bigger, poster-sized versions of that periodic table, you can order those from our Redbubble page. Links to both pages can be found in the navigation of this here website. Okay, last time around, we had a wonderful interview with Jean Heglin, author of Still Time, and she was kind enough to give us an autographed copy of the book, which even without the autograph is a great piece of work. And I figured it would make a great contest prize. But what should be the contest? Well, the next podcast is our usual wrap-up, which usually, and will this time, include a casting and a concept. So I take my cue from that. So here's the question. Who would you want to see tackle the role of Lear today? The only limitation is that the person, male or female, needs to be currently working. So no Laurence Olivier or Jack Nicholson. Name your Lear and back it up with your rationale. You can either tweet it to me with the hashtag MyLear4BSP, that's the number 4 and the initials for the Bill Shakespeare Project, or if you want to get more in-depth, i.e. longer than 140 characters and therefore more likely to win, you can either put it in the comment in the thread of this podcast or the last podcast, or you can email it to me at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. Be aware, though, that we have a deadline of Wednesday, May the 25th. I'll pick the winner on that day and ask the winner to read his or her pick and reason on the air for our end of month and end of play podcast. So pick your Lear and win an autographed copy of a great book. Now, I love a good concordance. A quick reminder for my first-time listeners. A concordance is a reference material that counts and chronicles every use of a particular word within a collection of works. For use in this blog and podcast, I like to use the one over at Open Source Shakespeare. And in this podcast, I want to take a look at nothing in King Lear. The word nothing. So why nothing? Well, the word crops up so often in the first act, 18 times in 14 speeches, that it feels like Shakespeare is slapping us in the face with it, especially when he uses the word in a pair of repeating or almost repeating phrases, as well as in a pair of exchanges in which the word is used in rapid succession. That's the why. The how many is a little tougher to pin down. Nothing is used 34 times in the play, in 29 speeches, finishing first either way you count it within the canon. The Winter's Tale also has 34 uses, but in only 26 speeches. One speech uses the word a whopping 8 times. Hamlet uses the word 30 times in 27 speeches. King Lear's first nothing exchange is the play's most famous, and it is what sets the main plot into motion. When Lear asks to hear what Cordelia can say to best what her sisters have said in their professions of love, Cordelia says, "Nothing, my lord." Lear, "Nothing?" Cordelia, "Nothing." Lear, "Nothing will come of nothing. Speak again." Without her statement of love, Lear is lost, ultimately disinheriting her and sending her away. Later in the scene, as he pushes her further and further away, you can almost hear Lear emphasizing, if not relishing, the next two uses of the word, "and nothing more," and "nothing I have sworn." In a wonderful piece of irony, Edmund's first words to his own father, after his own statement of villainy to us, echoes Cordelia's first words to her father, "Nothing, my lord." This creates the two offspring's oppositional roles for the remainder of the play. Gloucester's response is like Lear's repeated use of nothing. The quality of nothing hath not such a need to hide itself. Let's see, come. If it is nothing, I shall not need spectacles. This exchange sets into motion the subplot of the play. That the speech also contains one of the great motifs of the play, eyesight as in spectacles, is just an added bonus. The next major use comes within 24 lines of the first appearance of the fool in the play. After the fool recites a rhyming speech for the king, Kent says, "This is nothing, fool." Fool. "Then 'tis like the breath of an unfeed lawyer, you gave me nothing for it." "Can you make no use of nothing, nuncle?" Lear. "Why no, boy. Nothing can be made out of nothing." Lear tells the fool that, quote, "nothing," unquote, cannot create anything. Only now, the certainty in Lear's mind, will, has been reduced to theory, conjecture, or maybe just hope, can. Within the next 50 lines, the fool will use the word 3 more times. The first is to tell Lear what remains of his kingdom after dividing it between his 2 eldest daughters. The second begins one type of usage for the word that is repeated throughout the play, equating a person with nothing. "Thou art nothing." The third is the start of another linguistic motif, the saying of nothing, though you say nothing, which of course harkens back to the first usages of the word in the play, the utterance of "nothing, my lord" by Cordelia. The equation motif is seen again in Kent's insult of Oswald, "art nothing but," and again in Edgar's transformation into poor Tom, "Edgar, I nothing am." Later, during Edgar's slow emergence as himself, his father, the now blind Gloucester, thinks he hears a change in poor Tom's speech. Edgar, in order to maintain his disguise, must say, "In nothing am I changed." This negation of linguistic change and the re-equation with nothing, "nothing am I," also deals with the motif of "nothing speak," which is also found in statements by Edmund, "Have you nothing said?" Lear, "I will say nothing." And Gloucester, "Go to, say you nothing." Interestingly, these usages all prompt for the saying of nothing, but it was the saying of the word nothing that set all of this into motion. And all this, at least from Lear's perspective, is about his daughters. Thus, it is not surprising then that even the concept of nothing is centered on them and him. With poor Tom in the hovel, Lear can only ask, "Couldst thou save nothing? Wouldst thou give his daughters all?" When Kent tries to tell the king that poor Tom doesn't have any daughters, Lear cannot believe it. Nothing could have subdued nature to such a lowness but his unkind daughters. For Lear, everything, and thus nothing too, comes back to his daughters. All of these nothing references may be too much for some reading the play, and it may be overkill, especially when the last usage is such a false step. When Albany challenges Edmund before the bastard's duel with Edgar, the equation motif just feels clumsy. "Thou art in nothing less than I have here proclaimed thee." The inclusion of that "in" helps make the meter scan, but it lessens the impact of the statement. And personally, I find it a shame. I just wish Shakespeare hadn't used "nothing" here. Why? Because the uses of the word "nothing" undergo an evolution here in the second half of the play. The penultimate use is found in Goneril's captured letter to Edmund in Act 4, Scene 5. But in the timeline of events within the play, it would have been composed and written earlier, before the actions of the previous scene in which the letter is referenced, Act 4, Scene 4. This is important because in Act 4, Scene 5 of King Lear, a curious thing happens to the use of nothing, to, for, and about Lear the character. The last live-action, real-time use of the word is Edgar's previously discussed denial of change to his father. In the remainder of the scene, however, for Lear, nothing disappears, replaced by anything but. Lear laments how his daughters flattered me like a dog to say aye and no to everything I said aye and no to. They are not men of their words. They told me I was everything. 'Tis a lie. He may be nothing, but he'll no longer say nothing, the word nothing. Even Gloucester seems to pick up on this. "O ruined piece of nature, this great world shall so wear out the world to naught." Again, Lear may have become nothing, not, but Gloucester will no longer use the word. When Cordelia's soldiers arrive to take Lear, they tell him, "You shall have anything." Lear shall have anything. Nothing is gone. Except that it's not. That clumsy final nothing line by Albany ruins it. Oh, and one more thing. Only 3 plays in the entire canon, King Lear, As You Like It, and Hamlet, use nothing, not, everything, and anything. Of course, this play leads the pack in usages of each of the four, and thus all four in total. But that's apropos of, well, nothing. A postscript. When this discussion appeared on the website, author Gene Hegelin noted, it could be claimed that there is a final time that nothing is spoken, and that's when Lear begs the dead Cordelia to speak again by asking her corpse, "What is it thou sayest?" In that instant, the difference between her saying the word nothing and saying nothing becomes excruciatingly clear. I wonder if the shift the play has been making from nothing to anything and everything doesn't somehow serve to make that moment when Cordelia literally says nothing even more agonizing. Another piece of direction I'd love to see in that final scene has to do with that moment when Lear comes on stage carrying Cordelia's body. His first words are howl, howl, howl. And I can't think of a production I've seen which the actor isn't somehow trying to howl those words as if they were an expression of Lear's own grief. But it always strikes me as really stagey, awkward, and insincere. Instead, I think that Lear is exhorting everyone else on stage to howl because Cordelia's dead. Howl, 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 he's commanding them, and when they are all too dumbstruck to obey him, he calls them men of stones. Now, those were the thoughts of Gene Hegelin, and that, dear listeners, is simply a brilliant observation. Thanks, Gene, for joining the conversation. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries over the course of the last, close to a month since our last regular podcast, you've missed out on subjects including Book Review, Still Time by Gene Hegelin, King Lear, Ages, An Analogy, Historical Setting, Muddy Waters, Death Day Celebration, Happy Deathiversary, Kingsman Shakespeare Company Deathiversary, The Recap, another King Lear analog, same play too, Periodic Table of Shakespeare Poster, now available, King Lear, A Fistful of Infographics, Names, Just Foolin', King Lear in Print, King Lear in Performance, Podcast 127, The Interview with Gene Hegelin, author of Still Time, Contest Time, King Lear, Next Stop, Bodyville, King Lear, Doing the Concord Dance in Nature, Titus Andronicus, A History of Violence, Infographic, The Guardian Shakespearean Solo, Edmund, Love, Not, and Marriage, Nothing from Nothing Leaves Nothing, Contest Time, A Gentle Reminder, The Great Globe Itself, Yay, King Lear, I've Got My Eye on You, and Burgundy and France. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page and our Twitter feed. Remember that those social media outlets are more for Shakespeare news and notes than for discussions of our current play under study. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And join us again for our next podcast, when we'll be wrapping up King Lear and giving away a great book. Hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for May the 15th, 2016. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. And we shall see thee anon.